What does success mean to you? That's how I begin my conversation with my friend Jared, who is by every standard a successful person. By 30, Jared had been part of an acquisition, an exec at Google and Square, as now general partner at Matrix. But Jared's an interesting dude outside of that too. We talk about how he views success, impact, relationships, and everything in between. Here's Jared. What does success mean to you?
I think that's probably changed over the course of my life. I was a kid that was sort of obsessed with money. I mean, when I was young growing up, I think I thought that making money was really what made you successful. And I was obsessed with Monopoly and figuring out every way that you could just keep people in the game as long as possible and do reverse mortgages and, you know, find any way around it. And it's strange, you know, I went to college and our mission statement at school was to educate the hearts and minds to change the world. And so we spent a bunch of time where people would talk about things that weren't monetary rewards or, you know, paths in life that didn't lead to the most money, but they seemed more fulfilling for people. And so it was interesting just to run into people who didn't use that as a success metric. And then I went through my life and I think it's still, you're sort of forced to use that as the easiest way to find success. You know, you talk to your peers and you graduate and they say, oh, well, what's your bonus? And how much money did you make? And how high of a paying job is that? And you're deciding between jobs, or, you know, we just sold our condo last week and you're looking at offers and you're like, well, what's the highest offer? And so I think for a lot of things in life, you're conditioned to really use money as the kind of the easiest, most quantifiable way to decide between them. And so I had a weird thing happen, which was, it's actually true of a lot of folks in Silicon Valley, but not in many other places, where when I was probably 26, 27, we sold the company that I worked for to Google. And I went to Google and I remember thinking, now I've hit my goal for how much money I want to make. Like, my salary was no longer a goal. And I felt a little lost. Like, what's next? Like, what am I working towards? I'm not trying to get promoted. Like, even when you're thinking about promotions, those promotions are often tied to, you want to get promoted so you make more money or you manage more people or you have more responsibility. But I was like managing all the people that I wanted to manage. I had a bigger job than I thought I would have for many, many years. And I was making more money than I thought I would make. And so it was really clarifying and I think good for me to be in a position where then I had to choose what I wanted to do based on things that now, you know, evaluating it from a slightly older, hopefully more mature, more knowledgeable viewpoint, I think are more meaningful values. And from that core value system, I had to decide, well, what do I want to do next? Right. And so when I went to go to Square, I actually asked if I could take no salary.
No salary for all equity, or?
Yeah. I basically wanted to just trade down as much of my salary as possible so I could get more equity in the company. And part of that was like, you don't leave Google to go make more money somewhere else, more guaranteed money somewhere else. You leave because you really believe in something. And I wanted to help mom and pop shops and small businesses and really believe in this idea of creating jobs and like democratizing access to payments and helping these small businesses to be more knowledgeable and to grow their business. And it was, I think, self-validating in that as like, see, you can make a choice that's not driven by that, you know? And it was so deeply conditioned somewhere in the back of my mind from an early age that money equals success.
How do you think that came to be?
I just think it's all around us, right? Like, I think that even if you don't drive the flashiest car or you're not obsessed with spending money, I just think there's these subtle cues that happen in almost every part of your life that generally connect money to success and money to happiness. And money can buy lots of things, right? Like, it can make your life easier. It can get you back more time. It can give you more flexibility. It can help you focus less on chores in your life and more on things that you want to do. It can enable lots of experiences. And so I think it's not totally unreasonable to think that money correlates with happiness. But I do think that there's a certain level you reach of financial freedom or success where you kind of feel like, okay, well, either I'd have to hit some huge jackpot, like really step function up the finance side of my life to make a big difference, or it just doesn't matter, right? You've just cleared that hurdle for yourself. But I think that everything from movies and TV shows and celebrities and, you know, clothes and houses and all of these things push you to think money equals happiness.
Did you grow up in a family or in an environment or in a city that kind of reinforced that?
No, kind of the opposite. You know, I grew up in a mid-upper class upbringing in a place kind of like Marin County. It was nice suburbia, but we didn't have tons of money. We didn't spend tons of money. We didn't drive flashy cars. We had our wood-paneled station wagon. And, you know, I went to public school and just did all the normal things. And then when I was a teenager, I moved downtown into really the opposite of that, a place that was a block outside of extreme poverty. A nice neighborhood, but nothing special. And, you know, I actually had to go to private school because in St. Louis, the schools lost accreditation. The city of St. Louis, all of the schools. And you hear Nelly rapping about going to University City High School and going through metal detectors and people getting stabbed and shot. Like, that's the school that I would have gone to had I gone to public school. But there wasn't a day that I didn't get reminded from my family that I was going to private school. It wasn't a day that I didn't think about it. And I had a job from the earliest age that I could. So I think money was always something that was important, but it was never easy, and it was never thought of as like something that made you better or more important than someone else or something that was success in my family.
Let's cycle back a little bit. How were you talking about how you're 27, you sold this company to Google. How did you do that by 27? To what abilities do you credit that success to?
I can take some credit, I guess, for us selling the company, but it was my company. I didn't found the company, I didn't start the company. I helped build it, I helped scale it, and ultimately helped sell it. It's amazing how far hard work goes. And I think there's so many amazing, really bright, smart people that are driven in Silicon Valley. But you can always put in one more hour. I get asked a lot about, you know, what would you do? What are the career hacks? Like, you've been able to move really quickly in your career. What did you do? And I generally fall back on just work your ass off. You know, I think if you're willing to put in the effort and if you care more and you're willing to work harder at it, that does a lot, right? Like, yeah. There's almost always going to be somebody else there who's smarter than you or comes up with a little bit better idea. But there's a lot of people who, when given the choice, will choose not to do that extra hour of work. And so for me, you know, the thing that I think shaped me was growing up in a family where hard work was just what we did. You know, my dad probably works 12, 14 hour days. He works 6 days a week, and he does a lot of that by choice. That's just kind of what I was brought up with. And so I think when I went into startups, for me, it was a really good fit. My first job was in corporate America. I was the first one in, the last one out, and it wasn't rewarded. It didn't, you know, I wasn't compensated more. I wasn't promoted faster. I wasn't rewarded for doing that work. And if anything, you know, was told, hey, you shouldn't work so hard. You know, you shouldn't put in so much. Like, this is just work. Yeah. You should chill out. You know, you should relax. You should have life and do that. And startups were this saving grace for me because I found all these people who cared as much as I did. Like, they wanted their work to be their life. And so I think, you know, when I went to Slide, this was back when people would work till midnight every night at their startup, and we were there on the weekends. And like,
you say, people don't do that anymore.
I think that, you know, it used to be kind of a disqualifying interview question when you would talk about work-life balance. It used to be that the expectation was that you didn't really have life; that your life was your work. And I've certainly modified, and I think matured in my feelings on it. But I think that's changed in Silicon Valley in general, that you look at startups now and they encourage their employees to have more of a balance between work and between their personal life. And yeah, I think people work fewer hours than they used to at the average company, the typical company. And that used to be almost frowned upon, you know, in the early 2000s, mid 2000s. But today I think that it's encourage in this idea of, you know, all hands on Fridays and leaving at 5 o'clock. Like, we just didn't have that. That wasn't part of the culture. Maybe that's for the better. Like, maybe people do better work now. But I think there's also some benefits that came from us really eating, sleeping, breathing, bleeding our company. And I don't know how you strike the perfect balance between those things, but I think both have positive attributes.
Let's kind of assume that we're talking to the person who works their ass off. We're talking to a very, you know, select group of people, and all things equal, they all work super hard. How did you, or how would you, again, pick the right company to either join or create? How would you find mentors? You know, what do you tell the people who you see yourself in, but who are like 6 years younger or just starting out?
I guess I'll answer with a question I got asked yesterday. So I was having lunch yesterday with a guy who said, do you think it's important that you're inspired by the people that you work with? I think the answer to that is you don't have to be, but it makes it a hell of a lot easier, right? There's ups and downs to every company. And so if you are inspired and you feel like you're doing your best work and you feel like you're working with other people who are doing their best work and that they're dedicated and passionate about what they're doing and you're learning and growing, and that just by working with those people, you're kind of doing your life's best work, I think there are very few scenarios in which you wake up 5 years later and you regret having done that. I think that if you conversely spend your time with folks that are kind of one foot in, one foot out, or they're not as inspiring, or they're just average, or you feel like you're the smartest gal or guy in the room, you know, I just think that you can easily get frustrated. And so, again, you don't have to find those people, but when I'm looking at a company and, you know, thinking, hey, is this a company that I want to be part of? I want to find an entrepreneur that inspires me. I want to find someone who thinks in a different way than I do, and where I'm sort of blown away by something that they do or some way that they approach the world. I want to see a skill set in them that I don't possess, or kind of a line of thinking that I didn't think of, right? And I think all of those are just different forms of inspiration. And if you're an employee and you're looking at working in a company, I think you should feel that when you go in to interview and you talk to people. You should feel like they are truly connected to what they're doing, that they care, right? That they really, really care about what they're doing, and that they're truly connected to the vision, that it's not lip service. It's not the hottest, latest, greatest thing. It's not something that they're doing for stardom or fame. You know, they're doing it because they're connected to it. Because the reality is, like, you've got these ups and downs. Sometimes it's in your favor. Sometimes the media cares what you're doing. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes, you know, you're working on the space that people care about and that has a lot of attention. But there's all sorts of dips when you're at a startup. And how do you survive those dips? How do you continue to weather the path and go against the storm when everyone in the world around you says you're going to fail, right? When everyone is betting against you because you're at a startup and literally the odds are stacked against you. When everyone else says you can't do it and that it's just not going to happen and you should cut your losses and stop while you're ahead, it's really hard to be your own energizer bunny of motivation all of the time. So when you do that in a cohort of other people that truly believe that, that can carry you through, right? And that gets you through that dip and on to the next battle.
You were an early employee at Slide. Were you on the founding team? Were you all
set? I joined a couple years after the company was started. I guess it depends where you put that start date for when it became a real company. But I joined, I think it was employee about 50. And then through, you know, natural time, some of those early employees left. So by the time we sold the company, I think I was probably one of the 10 longest standing employees of the company. So it was sort of weird to join a company and feel like, I don't know, it was my first start, but I had no idea if this was big or small or what it was going on. But by the end, I felt like, you know, one of the old wise men and women of the company.
And because Keith Raboit actually yesterday at lunch said that, so he believes in the rocket ship theory, you know, get whatever seat it on it is, get on a rocket ship. But he kind of thinks you should get on after it's already a rocket ship in terms of opportunity. Was it already a rocket ship when you joined?
Yeah, it was. So Slide was this widget company that was taking over the world. We were making these flash squares, kind of like a YouTube video player, but for photos. Back when it was really expensive to host and serve photos. And so the social networks on Friendster and MySpace and whatnot, they would limit the number of photos you could upload, which today seems crazy, right? Because we know that photos are the backbone of most social products and social interactions. And so people build these networks around photos Facebook wants you to put all of your photos on their site. But back then, it was really expensive. One of our biggest bills was our Akamai CDN. And so we were, I think Max had the foresight that these photos were really important and meaningful to people. And so if we could own those photos and we could be that space, that's what people really wanted to keep updated. And so Slide was huge. I mean, we were touching probably 80, 90 million unique people a month when I joined. Probably over 100,000 slideshows created every day, and probably 100 million unique impressions in a day. And so it was a big company. It was on the cover of Wired magazine and Fortune and all of this. And it was fascinating to be there as it kept going up and to be part of that. And then as MySpace and Friendster and Bebo and Hi5 and Blackplan and MVU and Giggy and all of these sites, some that maybe you haven't even heard of, really went down. Yeah. And as Facebook went up, and Facebook came up with no flash autoplay. And so our beautiful videos of people's photos became static images with play buttons on them. Right. And that fundamentally shifted our ability as a company. We couldn't, instead of having video inventory effectively, we had static photos. Mm-hmm. And so we had to figure out, how do we as a company think about this new ecosystem? Social looks really different than the pimped out MySpace profiles that people would visit. Now it's Facebook pages with apps and boxes. And back then there was a wall instead of a news feed. And how do we not just survive, but thrive in that environment? So we really pivoted the business, started doing apps, and really changed over the course of the next couple of years.
Okay, so 27, money is no longer the number one goal, or you have some, so you now think about other things. Ultimately, now you're 30?
Yeah.
How do you think about your success now?
Sure. So I'm realizing if I'm 30 now, then I guess that was a long time ago. So it was 5 years ago. So I guess I was 25 when we sold the company. You know, it's interesting. So I went from Google to Square. And at Square, I got to do some things that I'd never done before. At Slide, I got to do things I'd never done before. And for me, one of the biggest things is I realized that building a team really was rewarding. It really made me happy. I think that most people become managers because they have to. They view it as the next step in their career, the next thing that you do if you want to grow and go to the next level. And it was partly that, but I jumped from managing a 2 or 3 person team to managing a 40 person team. And from managing people where I really understood the problem and what we were working on and what these people's jobs were, you know, working in business development, getting more senior and feeling like, okay, I've got this, I understand this, to managing engineers and designers and community folks and product folks and areas that I had never worked in, where clearly these people were going to be better than me at what they did. And that was a huge wake-up call, because I had no idea. Like, that was never in my goal sheet. That was never in my, you know, what do you want to do in your life? I never thought that I wanted to work in product or that I wanted to manage a product team. And so for me, it was really rewarding. And when I went to Square, I knew that one of the things I really wanted help with was scaling out the company and building the company into something that could be huge and, you know, at some point, you know, really take over how we do transactions in the world. And so I joined Square as an advisor. I had about 30 people, and then full time around 100. And one of the most rewarding parts about being at the company was finding the open space and hiring people into that open space and giving them the freedom to go do amazing things. So my team was probably 10 people or so when I joined, and a little over 70 when I left. And the company went from 100 people to 750. So going in 18 months from 100 to 750 is a crazy experience. And you really have to think about what drives people and what gets them excited and what makes them happy. And I think that, again, a lot of people that are in a management role, they're not in it because they like managing people or because they spend lots of time thinking about organizational dynamics or incentive structures or comp programs that make people feel good. And when we went to Google, we had to think about that. You know, we were going into a big company and trying to figure out, how do we keep our team motivated? How do we keep it feeling like a startup? So we started bringing dinners in and catering dinners in the San Francisco office, because Google SF didn't do that for their employees. It wasn't a late night culture. It was a sales office. People were in early in the morning. we started to think about, how do we do community activities? How do we connect with the other Google teams that work late at night that have a similar culture? How do we build our own reward system and structure so that our team is really happy within the broader Google ecosystem? And a lot of that then is thinking about, like, how do you design your organization? How do you design your culture? And how do you respect the fact that you're part of a larger organization, but also, you know, respect and recognize what your employees want and the environment they want to be in? And so when I went to Square, that was really important for us, going from effectively like a startup into a much bigger company, hiring C-level executives, building out a management team, building out a middle layer of management. So introducing this idea of having managers and directors and layers. And that's one of the hardest things that you do. And so I think that I found that to be really rewarding. And when I started to think about, you know, what did I want to do after Square, a big part of that was, how do you work with people on building their companies, right? And so that's a big part of why I do what I do now, is, you know, trying to help people build their companies and make them really successful. And a huge piece of that is having CEOs that come in that are really passionate about a vision or a product or an idea that they had, but they weren't really signing up. They, you know, they manage people or grow teams or hire because they have to. They talk to the media or develop a narrative or blog because they have to in many cases. And the reality is, like, that's a huge part of how you build a successful company. You hire really great people, you often can build a really successful company. If you fail at hiring great people and building a good team, it's very, very difficult to build a good company and a big company and a successful one. So I think that now I'm in a position where I can help people do that, and I find a lot of satisfaction from it, but I never expected that that was going to be, you know, one of the things that would really check the box for me.
What are other boxes that you haven't checked yet?
So I always have like this dream to kind of have a legacy. You know, you want to have an impact on the world. You want to leave your thumbprint on the world to an extent. I've oscillated on this back and forth. You know, I think that at Slide, we were training people to be entrepreneurs. And so you thought success is going to start your own company. And a lot of people came out of Slide and started their own companies. And I'm a little undecided on that now. You know, I don't know or think that I need to be the CEO of a company and the founder of that company to really have a lasting impact on the world or to be happy, you know, with what I've done with my life. But I do think that one way that you can touch the world is directly. You know, you can build a company, you can touch people's lives, you can cure cancer, you can do things that like really have a downstream impact. But there are lots of ways to do that. And through people is one of them, right? If there were the 10 greatest CEOs in the world and there was a person that helped those people develop, there was a person that helped those people get to where they are today, I don't know, I think that person can feel pretty good about themselves, right? They have sort of a derivative impact. And to some extent, the success that each of those 10 amazing people have is tied back to that coach, that advisor, that investor, that whoever that person was, that really helped them get to where they are. So some part of me hopes that as an investor, maybe that's something I can do. You know, you could be the money or coaching or advice or help that enables a person to build a company that changes the world. And that is one step removed. You know, it's a proxy of having that impact by having built that company yourself. But I think that it's just as valid. And in fact, if you had 5 years and you could develop 5 people that go off and start 5 amazing companies, you would arguably have more of an impact than if you started a company yourself. So I don't know. I mean, the verdict is still out for me a little bit, but I would love on my deathbed to be able to look back at my life and know that I had an impact that touched hundreds of millions of people or billions of people and made their life better, and specifically better, not just that I impact how they did something in their life or change it, or they use my product or widget or, you know, whatever it is, but that in some way the work that I've done in my life has done something good and made their life better.
You mentioned deathbed. What would you want people, yeah. Nice segue, what would you want people to say at your eulogy about you as a person, which includes your work, but includes obviously beyond your work as well?
You know, it's really weird to think about how you spend your life. And so people do this test of, if you knew you were going to die at the end of the day today, how would you spend the hours between now and then? And almost every person will tell you they would spend them differently. and the way they're going to spend them. I think it's a really tough thing to come to grips with. You know, like, you can't, people say, oh, live every day like it's your last.
If it was my last, I'd be running around naked, like, just doing all sorts of weird shit.
Interesting. Okay. Naked isn't one of the qualifying characteristics for me that you know, but maybe, I don't, maybe some part of it I'd be naked for, probably, but it's hard, right? Because you can't, we do things in our life that is work, or that is not just pure pleasure. There's the work that you do, and sometimes that work is to create opportunity, freedom, flexibility, financially or otherwise, to enable you to do the things that you want for pleasure. And then there's the short term and long term, right? For you, if building a family is a long term goal and that gives you this deep rooted sense of happiness, that is not the most pleasurable experience in the next 5 hours.
Right.
If I was like, go build a family, you know, there, how do you even do that, right? You better go find someone to procreate with and, you know, get going. But there are lots of things that you can do that give you immediate satisfaction and immediate enjoyment. It is a little odd that I think for most of our lives, we optimize for a very limited set of boxes of success metrics that we perceive as being good. And they're okay, you know, they're probably fine. And once we achieve them, that at that moment, we're forced to question, like, well, what's next, right? This is like the money thing for me. Once you make enough money in a job that salary is no longer your goal, you're not trying to get that up, then you're going, well, what do I really want? Because you're left going, well, if I still have want or wantingness in my life, well, then I've been lying to myself. It wasn't salary that mattered to me. It was impact, or it was team, or it was responsibility, or it was whatever it might be. And so I think it is a mystery to us, and we try to solve that. We try to answer that question by kind of testing different things. At the end of the day, like, I want people to think that I was a good person and that I did good things with the limited time that I had and the gift that I had of, you know, being on the earth and living in San Francisco and having all the wonderful things that have been afforded to me. If you ask yourself, well, if that's the most important thing, if the most important thing is that you're a good person and that you did good things, then shouldn't you go volunteer every day? Like, shouldn't you quit your job? And shouldn't you go feed people at a soup kitchen? And shouldn't you just help people on a day-to-day basis? And so I think you run into this thing of, if I do these activities, like, why is it that you do activities that are different than what would make you happy? And maybe there's the short term and the long term, but even if you can see the long term and you say, on my deathbed, I want people to say nice things about me and to think that I was a good person and to know that I was a good person and to, you know, just really care, to care that you're gone, to feel like there's a void that you've left, that you'll be missed, and that somebody has to come in and fill in that void, right? Like, the worst thing would be no one notices, right? Wouldn't that be awful? And so, and yet we don't optimize for those activities, but I think that's, maybe that's logical. Should everyone in the world volunteer? Should they go to Peace Corps or Teach for America or whatever the different organization might be that can do really amazing work in the world? And I think, yeah, you should spend some part of your life figuring out how you give back and how you help. But there are some people who are really good at sandbagging, right? Like, if I do the organization, is it Houses for Humanity? Homes for Humanity?
I think something for Humanity.
Habitat for Humanity, yeah. So I am not the biggest, strongest guy, and I've never built a home in my life. I'm not particularly good at plumbing or building or this. But there are people who are amazing at that, right? Who are just unbelievable, and they can build houses at 10x the quality and skill and speed that I can.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have to figure out where this intersection point is for you, right? What is the thing that you're best at that you can do better than anybody else in the world? And how do you do that, right? Like, that's your success, right? That's the thing that you can contribute. And so there's this question that I think everybody has to ask themselves, which is, what's the Venn diagram of the things that you're both good at and that you like doing and that are good in the world or create value in the world? And maybe it's create value, and maybe good in the world is a side thing that you've got to figure out, because some people, maybe they're really amazing at making money.
Yeah.
And maybe they should make money And as long as it's not something that like hurts someone, maybe they should make money. Maybe they should give that money away or fund someone else building houses or, you know, fund other projects. Like maybe there are people who aren't good at making money, but they're really good at building houses or they're really good at, you know, something else. And so I think you've got to figure out if you were master of all labor and all minds and all people, you would ideally optimize around the people doing the thing that they're best at and hopefully the thing that they love or that they really enjoy and the thing that creates the most value. And you'd optimize around that value creation. And then you would hope that you could figure out what is there that we can do in the world that creates good, you know, that's good for other people. And how do we take the people that are doing the things directly, right? Whether it's building a company or building houses, how do we take those people that can do that work directly and connect them with people that have capital and people that can help them lead and people that can help them build teams and help them scale?
Well, let's make this really clear because I remember you explained to me once that made so much sense. So you could sandbag or you could, remember you had this whole kind of ladder of how it was all connected. Can you explain that ladder and then we'll let you go?
So there's the Red Cross on one end and the Red Cross provides the bags and the sand and the transportation and the snacks. And on the other end, you have like people volunteering their time who are taking those raw materials and putting them together. But if you go up from the Red Cross, they have Red Cross Corporate who's raising money and trying to get donors and trying to get people to fund their efforts. And they have disaster relief and they have SWAT, you know, dispatch teams and all of this. And so I think you've got to figure out where you are in that ladder. Are you all the way at the labor end where you can help with your hands? Are you where you're helping with your mind? And this isn't really linear in the sense of like labor and minds may be equal, right? There's no value assessment there, but it's a question of, you know, should you be helping with your hand? Should you be helping with your mind? Should you be helping with your money? Should you be helping with some other thing? Maybe there's something that we haven't even thought about with your designs, with your product, with your innovation. But ultimately at the end of the day, you're trying to create value. You're trying to create something that gives back and does good in the world.
And just go up for a second, for Red Cross Corporate, there was like, you know, I think universities who fund Red Cross Corporate, and then from universities, it was VC funds because universities invest in venture capital funds.
Yeah, so
you keep going up on the chain.
You think about it as VCs and you're like, oh, you invest in companies and hopefully those companies have a return. Turns out the people that give us money and the limited partners are often nonprofits and endowments and universities. And when we make money for those organizations, they can build out their campuses and develop new programs with help, which helps to educate people that can then go and build the next Red Cross. And so I think these things are much more interconnected than people realize, the good side of it and the bad side of it. You know, the people that are doing good in the world and the people that aren't doing good in the world, that really, you know, you throw the rock in the pond and it ripples and those ripples hit each of us. And so whether you're doing investing that's helping the endowment and that endowment that's funding the university that is educating the next CEO of the Red Cross that's building out these programs, that's providing resources and supplies, that's helping disaster victims. And at some point there are people using their minds and their hands in order to put sand in bags. Like every person in that food chain is doing something that helps.
Derek, thank you for taking the time. I think people are going to have interesting thoughts about this one.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.